It's not just about the antebellum period. It's not just about history up till 1865. It's about the continuing ramifications of subjugating an entire group of people and crafting a narrative of superiority and inferiority along racial lines to bolster that system of oppression.
Welcome to the BJC Podcast as we continue our special series on Christian nationalism. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC, and your host for this series. This week, we continue our exploration of the topic of Christian nationalism with another look at history. A few weeks ago, we did a deep dive into history with two scholars, Dr. Stephen Green and Dr. Bill Leonard, as we considered the question of whether the United States was founded as a Christian nation. As good as that conversation was, it only told part of the story. In today's episode, I talk with another historian about how American Christianity and racism have overlapped for more than 400 years. Today, I'm pleased to talk and learn with Jamar Tisby, the author of an excellent, important, and difficult book titled The Color of Compromise: The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. Jamar co-hosts the Pass the Mic podcast and is president of The Witness, a Black Christian collective that engages issues of religion, race, justice, and culture from a biblical perspective. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Mississippi, focusing on race, religion, and social movements in the 20th century. Jamar, welcome to the BJC podcast.
Thank you, and thank you so much for doing this really important, vital, timely series.
Well, we are so happy that you are joining us on this series on Christian nationalism. And on each of our episodes, I'm asking each guest to define Christian nationalism, to tell us how you understand that term.
Yeah, so I would generally describe it with one more word: white Christian nationalism. Obviously, people of any race or ethnicity can sort of buy into the ideology, but it is an ideology that promotes this notion and this construct of whiteness. And so as I would define or at least describe white Christian nationalism, it's a conflation of identities in a really harmful way. So it's the conflation of national identity with being white. So that to be a true American, authentic American, is to be white. And you can think of even pop culture, the figure of Captain America is a white man, and he's supposed to represent the sort of quintessential American patriot. And so that conflation of a racial identity and even a gender identity in some sense. And the Christian part is the conflation of a Christian identity with a national identity, so that the new Israel for white Christian nationalists is essentially the United States of America. And we have this divine function and this superior place on the national stage as God's chosen nation. And it is not a biblical people who follow Jesus Christ who are defined as God's people. It's the nation of the United States that's defined as God's people and therefore has a special place in the world.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's really helpful to have that frame and to understand how this complicated idea and ideology shows up in different ways and from different perspectives. In the Christians Against Christian Nationalism statement, for which this podcast series is a companion, one line of the statement that I really wanted for us to focus on as we have this conversation today is that Christian nationalism often overlaps with and provides cover for white supremacy and racial subjugation. And I've learned in the several weeks since the statement launched that there's a lot of confusion about what that means, and in some ways even some defensiveness and hostility that we're even raising a question of racism in this project. And there's a FAQ section of the Christians Against Christian Nationalism statement, and we answer this question: why link Christian nationalism and racism? And the way that we've answered that question on the website is that The deep abiding problem of racism in this country is much larger than this project, and yet it is undoubtedly connected to this conversation. We recognize the overlap between Christian nationalism and white supremacy, and the fact that not all Christians or signers of this statement will view the connection in the same way. And I bring that up to help orient our conversation today, because you're a real expert on this issue. You have literally written the book, The Color of Compromise, and how racism and American Christianity have been intertwined from the beginning. Before we get into that, I'd love some definitions from you, too, on racism and white supremacy and how you understand and write about those terms in the book.
Sure. Racism can be defined in any number of ways, and it's really smart to define those terms before we start talking about it. In the book, I go with a very simple definition that others, such as social psychologists like Beverly Daniel Tatum, use, which is racism is a system of oppression based on race. Another very shorthand definition of racism is prejudice plus power. And in both of those definitions, there are some key words. In the first one, it's system. The idea that there are policies in place that create and perpetuate racial inequality. In the other definition, it's power. The idea that everyone and anyone can be prejudiced, but not everyone and anyone has the power to impose those prejudices on other people, namely through policy. And so racism is that combination of both prejudice and power. White supremacy is sort of a catch-all term for what my friend and the author of the book White Awake, Daniel Hill, he calls the narrative of racial difference. And it's the idea, it's the story that we tell that the amount of melanin in one's skin is actually an indicator of their existential worth and their value. And the ways that manifests in terms of white supremacy is one, that white or that which is coded as white, whether culturally or an individual, is deemed supreme or superior. Another way to think of that is that white is the center and everything else is peripheral. It's the old analogy of going into the grocery store. It's all just food in every aisle until it's ethnic food. And the idea being that if you are Latino or Latina, Asian descended, Native American descended, African descended, then you are other and whiteness is normal.
Super helpful. And especially to have that really real world example that we have all encountered whenever we go grocery shopping. You know, I've read your book and I find it really essential reading for congregations and for individuals who are interested in racial justice. It's readable and it's not overwhelming in its length, though it is very ambitious in its scope. It covers more than 400 years of political and religious history in American life, and no denomination, major denomination, escapes, you know, your very close look. We have Methodists, Episcopalians, Baptists, Calvinists, Presbyterians, Roman Catholics, Pentecostals, even luminaries that we all know like George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the premise of your book, The Color of Compromise, and what you hope it accomplishes.
Yes. So the idea is that the racist status quo in America could not have formed or been perpetuated without the cooperation, oftentimes, of the church. And when I say the church, I mean specifically the church in what became the United States, and more specifically, predominantly white Christian churches and denominations. And the idea of complicity is this. Most of the time when we think about racism and racists, we're thinking about the extreme examples. We're thinking about the leaders of the Confederacy, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. We're thinking about the Ku Klux Klan, people who put on robes and hoods and burned crosses in lawns. We're thinking about mass murderers and mass shootings. And when we think of those extreme categories as the only racists, what happens is we overlook the vast majority of people, this very large group of people who may not have been the ones out, you know, planting dynamite outside of a church in Birmingham. But we have to recall the fact that people, what they tolerate and what they protest or what they don't protest, what they speak up about or what they don't speak up about, create a context where those kinds of extreme forms of racial terrorism can take place. And so what the book is talking about is throughout centuries of history in North America, Christians, particularly white Christians, instead of courageously confronting racism when they could, opportunity after opportunity, instead they chose complicity and compromise, and in so doing, created a racial caste system in the United States and helped perpetuate it.
The quote that really stuck out for me from the introduction was this one: historically speaking, when faced with the choice between racism and equality, the American church has tended to practice a complicit Christianity rather than a courageous Christianity. And it's that idea of complicity and courage that you speak to that I think is really laid out beautifully in the book. What also stuck out to me was this idea that whenever the Christian religion became too tightly associated with the state, it really provided cover for white supremacy and racial subjugation. And it started way back in the colonial era. And the way that you talk about Christianity and the slave codes and how those originated was, I think, very useful. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that history?
One of the facts that really stuck with me in my research was that all the way back in 1667, the Virginia Assembly, which was a group comprised of white Anglican men, they made a law that said baptism would not free an enslaved Native American person of African descent or mixed race background. And that really stuck with me for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is a group of Christian men. This is 17th century in a society where you really couldn't be a public figure in good standing unless you were part of the church. And at that time, it was British colonial Virginia, so the church was the Anglican church. So it's a group of Christian men. They're making a law, which is political, about baptism, which is religion. And so you get this conflation of politics and race and religion all the way back, you know, several centuries ago. So those things are inseparable, even as we talk about them today. And they're saying, they're creating this dichotomy between a person's spiritual well-being and their physical or material well-being, which is an argument that persists into the 21st century. It's the just preach the gospel folks who think that by converting people, the world will be a better place sort of almost naturally without any sort of working towards systemic or institutional change. And they'll say that as you talk about those changes, then that's a distraction from the gospel. And that has a very old history.
Well, we're having our conversation today just a few weeks after the New York Times launched its new initiative called the 1619 Project. And it's a major effort from the country's leading newspaper to try to contextualize American history with an eye towards the institution of chattel slavery and how that has really defined the American experience. In reading your book, I could not help but see a very direct parallel to what I think the New York Times is trying to accomplish in just even bringing the year 1619 to Americans' consciousness as the beginning of slavery in what would become the United States. I'm just curious about some of your reactions to the 1619 Project and also to the backlash that it has inspired by some.
So when we talk about white Christian nationalism, any information, any data that refutes the idea of American exceptionalism will be rejected, will be questioned, will be undermined. And the reason behind that is white Christian nationalism relies on this narrative of the United States as this shining city on a hill. And so what happens when that city is shining and on a hill because enslaved people built that city and they dragged the bricks up that hill. And then you start to see, well, this shining city isn't so shiny when you look into it. So white Christian nationalists are going to push back on something like the 1619 Project, which takes as its whole focus the idea that the United States was founded on the economic exploitation of race-based chattel slavery, which is what that institution was. It was a way for capitalists to maximize profit and minimize loss by cutting costs, namely not paying their laborers who were African-descended people and enslaved. And so when you start revealing that history, when you start talking about the United States from the perspective of people of color, that is to say the perspective of the marginalized and oppressed, suddenly America is exceptional, but not for the good reasons. America is exceptionally bad for its brutal form of enslavement, a form of slavery that did not go away until we fought the nation's bloodiest war to this day. The Civil War is the bloodiest war in America's history. And it took that catastrophic event that literally tore the nation apart to finally abolish the institution of slavery. And so the reaction is predictable. It's been happening for as long as people are talking about it. But what I think is the power of something like the 1619 Project is it makes the past public. And that's really, really important. We have a very shallow understanding as a nation of our history, especially when it comes to the really difficult parts like enslavement. But understand too that the 1619 Project, that's just a starting point. And the legacy of enslavement persists into the 21st century. So I want to be very careful to help people understand that it's not just about the antebellum period. It's not just about history up till 1865. It's about the continuing ramifications of subjugating an entire group of people and crafting a narrative of superiority and inferiority along racial lines to bolster that system of oppression.
Yeah, really powerful words here, and that the past is also our present, right? We can't understand where we are now if we don't understand from whence we came, right? And that, and you know, this idea of a very shallow history, I think I've also talked about it as a cherry-picked history, and it in the idea of our founding as a Christian nation, when people put forward that idea, it is cherry-picked quotes and anecdotes, and they're from, you know, founders, all of whom were white. And, you know, I think another way to provide additional context and provide a richer, more authentic history is to tell stories of people whom have been forgotten or overlooked by history. And that's another thing that your book really does a wonderful job of, is telling the history of some of these individuals, African-American individuals who stood up and provided really important contributions to our history. I just wonder if you might share, you know, one or two of those people that you studied and wrote about in your book.
For sure. There are so many stories, and this is why it really bugs me when history teachers make history boring. That should never be the case. History is fascinating because it's stories. It's stories of people's lives and what they did. So one of the tough parts about writing this book is that I had to tell the really hard stories, the painful ones. Part of the mission is to sort of debunk some of the myths that we have around people who have been put on pedestals. And one of those people is Jonathan Edwards, who some people call America's greatest theologian. He was a pastor and a theologian in the 18th century. And he's best known for a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and for Calvinism, and for this big revival that went on in his church and the surrounding area. But he was also a slave owner. And it really gripped me that, you know, it's one thing to say that this person enslaved other people. It's another thing to say that this person enslaved this individual. So we actually have records that show that the first person he bought was a young Black girl named Venus. And so to say that Jonathan Edwards enslaved not a nameless person, but Venus, to me is really poignant. And here we are praising this man's theology in some circles, and yet his theological anthropology didn't tell him that you can't make another person into property. So that's one story I tell. Another very painful story is the lynching of Luther and Mary Hulbert. I go into detail in the book, but it's really brutal. We have news reports from the time, this is in the early 20th century in Mississippi, of this lynching of two Black people, and the kind of torture from cutting off fingers and toes to using a corkscrew to remove chunks of flesh while they were still alive. We need to come to grips with the brutality, not just of slavery, but of Jim Crow segregation and of lynching. But I also get to tell other stories about the resilience of Black Christians in particular, that when we faced discrimination and oppression, even from white people who called themselves Christians, we didn't abandon the faith. We didn't leave, you know, the United States. We fought to make it better. And so I get to tell a few of those stories as well.
Yeah, I think the book is very honest and wide open about the horror, especially in the lynching sections that you talk about. But I also think overall, it's a very optimistic book. It's one you can tell that you have not given up on Christianity, that you have not given up on Christians and their ability to do something productive towards racial justice now. I did want to focus a little bit on, you had mentioned earlier something about the KKK and, you know, as an example of extreme racism. Something I really learned in the book was, if we contextualize history in the early 20th century, it wasn't such an extreme movement. And
that's right.
If you could tell us a little bit about what your research found there.
Yes. So when I say extreme, and this is a great question, so that we can delve into it a little bit more deeply. When I say extreme, I'm talking about forms of racial terrorism, where people actually took action, violent action, to intimidate Black people and their allies. But the group and the idea and the goals of the Ku Klux Klan, that was relatively widely shared. A lot of people don't recognize this, but the Klan has undergone three iterations. The first was right after the Civil War, in an attempt to, quote unquote, redeem the South and take it back for the white man. The last major iteration was during the Civil Rights Movement in protest to some of the gains that Black people were making. And then the second one, in many ways the most virulent, but also the most widespread, happened in 1915. And we talk about white Christian nationalism. Here is a case in point. The way it started was a white man in Georgia. He was a former circuit rider. So he was a former Methodist preacher. He got a group of his friends. They went up on the top of Stone Mountain, which is on the front of it is a bas relief of Confederate figures. And then what they did was they burned a cross, which was a tradition taken from Scotch-Irish lore. And then they built an altar, another religious symbol. And on the altar, they placed both a Bible and an American flag. And so right there, you have this religious, nationalist, white supremacist event happening. And that's what the Ku Klux Klan encapsulated and stood for. And there were hundreds of thousands, and some estimates put it in the millions, of people who were either card-carrying members of the Klan or very supportive of what the Klan was doing. So yeah, it's important that we remember. It may have been a small people who actually committed these acts of racial terrorism that we read about and remember, but they had a whole bunch of people supporting them, or at least not doing very much to oppose them.
I'm really glad you told that anecdote. And if you didn't, I was going to ask you about it, because the image of that idea of the Bible and the American flag on an altar out with a Confederate monument, that is very much tied up in the imagery of Christian nationalism and white Christian nationalism that we see today. And learning that this wasn't just a small minority of Americans who held these beliefs at that period of time, but how widespread it really was, is something that it went all the way to the White House.
Yes.
And it maybe share a little bit about what your research showed there. I know this story has been told about President Wilson, but I didn't understand or know the connection with Thomas Dixon Jr.
Sure, sure. Well, I found that a fascinating story. Woodrow Wilson was a cradle, from the cradle, he was on up, he was a Presbyterian, and he was the son of a Presbyterian minister. And what's interesting is his daddy's church is the place where the Presbyterian church, it split off from their northern counterparts, as did the Methodist and the Baptist. When the Presbyterians split, they named their new denomination for a brief time, the Presbyterian Church of the Confederate States of America. And the first meeting of the PCC SA was held at Woodrow Wilson's father's church in Augusta, Georgia. And so he grew up with that. And then when Woodrow Wilson became president of the United States, he is the first president who showed a movie in the White House. And the movie he showed was called Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation, in many ways, is the nation's first blockbuster film, raked in all kinds of money. But it was a piece of shameless propaganda for the KKK. Birth of a Nation purported to tell the rise, the genesis, the origins of the first iteration of the Ku Klux Klan after the Civil War. And the way that Dixon framed it, who made the movie, the way he framed it was the KKK was this noble group that was assembled to protect the virtue and honor of white women from rapacious black men and Union soldiers. The KKK was meant to take back the South from this terrible, misguided idea of Reconstruction that put black people in political and economic power. And so it needed to go back to white men who could manage those affairs well. And it was a piece of propaganda that had this idea of the Romantic South and these noble white people who were here to defend the nation and the character and virtue of the South. And that's what the president was promoting. He showed it multiple times to hundreds of people, hundreds of guests who came to the White House. And so from the very top of the political office all the way down to the local level, you have this idea of white Christian nationalism and white supremacy being promulgated.
Well, I think these stories just give a very, you know, small piece of what readers can find in The Color of Compromise and just how much history there is for to be told and to be learned and to be discussed and talked about. You know, in the conclusion of your book, you give a lot of suggestions about what people can do about racism. And as a reminder, we defined that at the beginning as a system of oppression based on race. What stuck out to me when you gave that definition, similar to our definition of Christian nationalism, that it's an ideology. It exists, right? We don't have to label people as racists or Christian nationalists. We're talking about systems that exist in our society. What can we do about that? So I'm just curious if you could maybe share with us what you think, in addition to signing the Christians Against Christian Nationalism statement, but what Christians might do to help others understand how Christian nationalism and white Christian nationalism can be complicit in racism.
The most frequent question I get when I give talks on the book or just talk about racism in general is what can I do? It's a how-to question. And I used to sort of just give a broad array of answers. Oh, try this, do that. I finally sort of grouped it into something that I think is helpful, at least for memory purposes, into an acronym called the ARC of Racial Justice. And ARC stands for Awareness, Relationships, Commitment. And the idea is that as you think about how to combat white Christian nationalism or how to reduce racism, you have to approach all three of these areas and keep them in tension somewhat, awareness, relationships, commitment. So the awareness piece means learning about race and racism. And so part of awareness means learning history. There is so much historical data that is accessible at the swipe of a finger, at the stroke of a key on the computer. You can just Google it. You can watch documentaries on this stuff. You can read something like the 1619 Project. And so all of this historical data is available, and yet so few of us access it. And we need that historical awareness, though, if we're going to be effective in opposing racism and white supremacy today. So awareness means informing yourself in all kinds of ways. Relationships, that's important, too. So at some point, the other has to become our brother or sister. We have to see other people not as them versus us, but as us together. And that happens most effectively through personal relationships. And for white people, that's difficult because you can maneuver in a white supremacist society without ever having meaningful relationships with people of color. And so for white people especially, you're going to have to go out of your way to develop relationships. It's not going to tend to happen in the natural course of your life, whether it's at your workplace or school or where you live. But that's not enough. A lot of Christians, particularly white evangelicals, sort of stop at the relationship part and say, well, look, I had a cup of coffee with somebody. We had a meal. I'm nice to people of color. I'm not a racist. Well, as is popular these days, particularly through Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, it's not enough to just be not racist. You have to be anti-racist. You have to actually consciously work against racist systems. And I focus on racist policies. I focus on not just being nice to other people, which is a good thing, but dismantling the systems, whether we're talking about mass incarceration, underfunding public education, disparities in healthcare between white and black and other people of color. I'm talking dismantling the systems that perpetuate racial inequality in all kinds of ways. So we've got to tackle awareness, relationships, and commitment as we look to reduce this problem of racism and dismantle this idea of white Christian nationalism.
Well, I'm really glad you included kind of your suggestions on the how-to at the end, because otherwise you might be left with this sense of pessimism again at the end of the book, but this idea that there is an opportunity to write a new day. And I think you have increased our awareness through your book, through this conversation today. And just thank you, Jamar, for joining us for this episode of the BJC podcast.
Thank you. And thank you for asking about the history. Believe it or not, when I talk about the book, there's not a lot of questions that get into the actual stories, dozens and dozens of stories about the history. And some of them are really vivid and poignant. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. And again, thank you so much for doing this really important series.
My thanks to Jamar Tisby for joining us today. For more from him on this topic, check out the Joy and Justice Conference, which will take place October 4th and 5th in Chicago. Organized by The Witness, this conference continues the 400-year journey of Black joy and justice from 1619 to 2019. You can learn more at joyandjustice.com. Thank you for listening to the BJC podcast as we continue this special series on Christian nationalism. New episodes come out each Wednesday, and you can catch up anytime on previous episodes. The BJC podcast is on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you listen. Subscribe to the BJC podcast to be notified when we release new episodes. And if you're enjoying this series, take the time to leave us a rating or review. You can also see a list of all episodes on our website. Visit bjconline.org/Christian Nationalism. And if you want to join us in speaking out against Christian nationalism and starting conversations in your community, read and sign the statement available online at christiansagainstchristiannationalism.org. Be sure to follow BJC on social media and let us know what you think of the podcast. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill. And you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. Thanks for listening, and join us on Wednesday for our next episode.